So I did what I often do with such things, and that was I made it a matter of prayer. And I went in fairly, I think fairly disturbed, or fairly in a bit of turmoil, I guess, because I had read a fair amount of LDS history up to that point before my mission, etc. You know, I knew Joseph was a polygamist, and yet I had not heard this particular charge, certainly not with this evidence that Van Wagener had kind of dumped in my lap and then moved on with. So I went in kind of intending to kind of kneel down and say to God, okay, you know, like, you better make this clear to me here, or, you know, like, you know, to demand almost, if that's not too arrogant a word. Probably is a bit arrogant, but that was the frame of mind I was in, I guess. You know, to sort of demand answers and say, look, you need to straighten this out for me, or this is not going to go well. But as I was praying, I found myself doing exactly the opposite, which I regard as, you know, simply a gift of grace. It's certainly no credit to me, really. It's just what I found myself saying. And what I found myself saying was that I was going to keep my promises to him, and that I would trust him, and that even if he didn't want to tell me anything about this, or even if this was something that I couldn't resolve, that was okay, that I would still trust him, that this was not a deal breaker for our relationship, we might say. And I felt immediately much better about the whole thing, and I felt very clearly, you know, go ahead and study this out, don't worry about it, you know, do the work, do whatever you want, kind of a carte blanche. Didn't tell me what I'd find, or didn't tell me what I'd conclude, but so as I look back, as you say, at that point, it was that act of, like I said, consecrating my brain, you know, this to say to God, you know, you don't have to explain yourself to me if you don't want to, I don't have to have all these answers. I don't have to be this smart apologist, if you will, who's got the answer boom, 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 and can rattle it off before the critics get it out of their mouth. I'm okay, or I will accept being thought deluded or cognitively dissonant or whatever label people wanted to throw on me if that's what was required. And that's the funny thing about consecration. You know, you have to be willing to do it, and then it seems like as soon as you really do it, then you get it all back with interest. And at least that was my experience. So,
now, some members of the church that have described maybe the feeling of shock about certain things they learn about Joseph Smith, we've talked about plural marriage, or maybe it's some other thing when they learn this, there are some people who really don't seem to care about it. They can kind of go on their way. There are other people who, you know, they're not bothered at all. There are other people who let it work on them and let it bring them down. There are other people who kind of roll up their sleeves and maybe go to work. Why do you think there are so many different kinds of reactions here?
$64,000 question. Yeah, some of it may just be our innate nature. You know, I mean, we all came here with certain tendencies or certain skills or lack thereof, and so some of it may just be the way we are. I think some of it too has to do with our past experience. You know, I was, like I said, you know, growing up in a home where you have a father who'll say to you, can't know if a book's not worth reading unless you read it. You know, I mean, that creates kind of a safe space to explore potentially difficult or troubling ideas of any sort. And so if you're accustomed to doing that, you've got a little bit of space. You've got a little wiggle room. You know, you don't panic quite as much. Maybe you can say, well, you know, I've kind of been here before about X, Y, or Z. You know, this, how bad could it really be? You know, when you sort of dive in. Like I said too, I think another part of it is the amount that people encounter. Anybody who wants to look into this, you know, you ration yourself. Not because I think there's anything out there that's really threatening, but because it does take time and effort and work, and where I often see people at is they've just kind of been overwhelmed or buried. You know, people have thrown enough mud that, you know, people think, well, you know, even if only 1% of what I've heard is true or has no good answer, then the church can't be true or Joseph wasn't a prophet. You know, so by that time, the sheer volume of stuff has become its own argument, even though 1,000 bad arguments doesn't mean much. It's still intellectually and emotionally overwhelming, I think. And some of it, too, probably has to do with the family they were raised in and how that, or their church experience. And, you know, do they think that questioning things is bad? What's their view of Joseph Smith? You know, do they have a very idealized portrait of him? Or are they aware of some of his human foibles? And so, because... you know, if they have a very kind of picture-perfect view of Joseph or of the church, then exploring this sort of thing doesn't just require them to reevaluate or to reappraise what they think about plural marriage. It requires them to literally remake their entire view of the gospel and the church and all their experiences in it. And I think it can leave them feeling like they have no safe place on which to lay hold, you know.
So, I mean, and where can they go at that point? Someone's reached that point.
Exactly, yeah. Well, you know, at the risk of tooting my own horn, I guess, I would say the first place you go is to God. You know, if you don't have that relationship, I used to tell people in France, you know, a bunch of hardcore atheists, if there ever was some. So I guess that was preparation for this kind of thing, if nothing else.
Sure.
You know, I used to tell them about what I called first order and second order questions. You know, they would say to me, you know, why should I give up my good French wine? And knowing what I do about French cooking, that's probably a really, really good question. You know, why should you? You know, if it was English beer or something, the question might be less difficult. But French wine, I mean, that is probably a tough one, I'm guessing. And I would say to them, I'd say that's really a second order question. The first kind of order question you need to answer is there a God? If there isn't, well, then none of this matters. If there is, then you need to answer one more question. That is, will he talk to me? Well, if he won't, then he may as well not exist at all, and we're back to square one. And if he does, then we need to know what he wants from you. And until you can answer that with some degree of confidence, or at least some, you know, you have to be at least in the ballpark on that question, everything else is, in a sense, moot, you know. But that strikes some people as a cop-out. You know, they think it's me just saying, oh, you know, you just need to read your scriptures and pray. Well, no, right. That isn't what you need to do. But if you're not doing those things, then nothing much else is going to help you, you know, because spiritual life is put on hold, as I said. You know, even if you come up with a perfect intellectual resolution 6 months later, where are you going to be spiritually in 6 months?
Yeah, and it seems to me, especially in Mormonism, we have a pretty strong emphasis on history itself. Our founding stories of Joseph Smith walking into the woods and meeting with God, meeting with Christ, this is something that we say happened in history. An angel brings a record of a historical people to him. This angel is part of that record. Joseph Smith translates this record. So we have this historical aspect of the faith, but then history is a very difficult thing, it seems to me, to access. So on the other side of it, we have the more personal thing between an individual and God, or between an individual, their fellow man, and God. So it seems to me that you're saying, when it comes down to it, that there are some priorities that you should consider when you're thinking about maybe historical questions, and which tie into your questions about God, too. So is that kind of what you mean, first order, second order?
Yeah, and that... And the second order questions will always, in my experience, be amenable to more than one answer. You know, I mean, people of goodwill really can interpret the evidence in more than one way. And probably the thing that's going to push you one way or the other is these first order questions. What do you think about God? What do you think about the meaning of life? You know, if you're an atheist, as many of the people who, or an agnostic, you know, as many of the people who've written this sort of history is, you know, if you believe the idea of talking to God or angels is fundamentally improbable or impossible, then it really doesn't matter what the historical evidence shows you. You're going to have to find another way to explain it, you know. And I can't say I blame them for that, but I think we should recognize that that's at work.
Another topic.
Sorry, I forgot the question.
it was basically just about first order, second order, and how
right. Sorry,
Mormonism
yes.
has the historical angle, but we also have. It seems to me the history is just as much of an invitation to seek a relationship with God and to learn about our interactions with other people. It seems to me the history is just as much about that as it is something that you might learn in a history class, or perhaps even more so.
Exactly. Yeah, I've since thought, you know, there's the part in the Book of Mormon where you know, Laman and Lemuel are complaining about Nephi, and they say to him, you know, what he's going to do is he's going to take us off into this far country, and then he's going to claim things about this country that we've never been to and that we can't see, you know, things about the Messiah coming and all of this. And I thought, you know, that's really what history is like. You know, it's this far distant country to whom, you know, we see through a glass darkly that we can't go visit. You know, we're at the mercy of the people who left reports and all their biases. And, you know, we could we could, I think, with Laman and Lemuel, say the exact same thing. Just as people have said the same thing about Christianity, at least its historical stuff is safely 2,000 years ago.
I think that's a really good point. And I guess going along that same, on that same token, Nephi's response to them is, again, an invitation for them to get a relationship going with God again. So I think that's
right,
interesting.
Yeah.
It kind of came full circle.
That's right. That was my point, which you reminded me of. So, yes, thank you.
That's good. We got a couple more minutes here before we go. Maybe you can tell the listeners a little bit about what the church itself, what the gospel means to you. Maybe some of the reasons why the gospel and church are meaningful for your life, and talk a little bit about that.
Well, it means everything to me. Saves me from death, hell, the grave, all of it. It's what gives us meaning. It's not something I can speak about with a great deal of composure, and on the other hand, it's something that I could talk about forever, because one thing leads to another. You know, if we didn't have the gospel, where would we be? If the church wasn't true, the world is a tragedy and doesn't mean much and all those sorts of things, you know? I mean, we're all slowly dying. I say that to people in medicine all the time. They'll come in worried about something, and I'll do blood tests more to reassure them than anything, and then they come back and they're all normal, and they'll say, "So I'm not dying." I'll say, "Oh no, you're dying." And they look at me, and then I say, "We're all dying. You know, you're just not dying any faster than the rest of us at the moment." And they laugh, but they get it, you know. But arguably, most of Western culture these days is dedicated to helping us forget that, you know, to either entertain or distract us from the idea that we are transient and not here for very long, and that we have it pretty good, but that most of the world does not, you know. And the gospel is one of the very few cogent, coherent answers to that issue that I've ever run across anywhere.
As far as cogency, I mean, everybody has questions about things. So what do you do with yours, and what do you advise people do with their questions?
You always keep them in mind. I'm surprised. People talk about putting stuff on the shelf. I don't so much put it on the shelf as I have a shelf next to my bed, so to speak, where I keep them and I look at them, and they're always on my mind, because it's amazing where you'll find answers to stuff when you really least expect it. You know, something that you've been wondering about or that's been bugging me. An example of that, just to pick a trivial one, is there's several places in church history where someone in the church will say, "We're not abolitionists. You know, we don't think slavery should be abolished." And I always thought, my, you know, that's kind of an unusual thing for Christians or for inspired people to say, you know. And I thought, well, they were people of their time. Maybe that just wasn't something they'd gotten. And then I was reading a biography of Abraham Lincoln that had nothing whatever to do with Mormons. They weren't mentioned at all in it. And it laid out kind of the how there were three broad views on that. There were abolitionists and there were slave advocates, both of whom were regarded by most of middle America as kind of extremists. And the other group was kind of this middle of the road bunch who kind of just wanted to let slavery wither on the vine. They weren't keen to, you know, disband the institution immediately with all the social disruption that it would cause down in the South and the economic collapse, etc. But at the same time, they weren't keen on it. They didn't admire it. And you know, things suddenly clicked. I said, well, again, not surprising that that's what they said, because that's what most of their contemporaries were of. They weren't abolitionists, because that was looked at as kind of an extreme, rabble-rousing position. In retrospect, we think it the noble one, and it probably was, you know, but it's not surprising that there was the mistake I was making, I guess, was that is I was looking at it as two things. Either you're a slave, you're either pro-slavery or you're abolitionist, but it's not. In context, there's this huge middle ground where most people were. You know, so if I hadn't had that in mind when I'd been reading, or if I hadn't been reading, I'd still be looking there. You know, now that troubles me not at all. It makes perfect sense in retrospect. So I guess that's the first step, is keep this stuff in mind, and, you know, you, to be a little bit cliche, you don't let what you do know be at the risk of that which you don't know. I mean, I think we all, in one way or another, if you want to really be a disciple of Jesus, faith is about trust. It's, you know, we why do you get married? When you get married, you don't. There's no way you can guarantee that your spouse is never going to cheat on you or isn't going to do something horrible. You marry them and you stay with them because you trust them. You take that kind of leap of faith, or you trust them to maintain the relationship. And I think it's the same with God. You know, certainly we know intellectually, or we ought to know intellectually, that we can trust Him completely. But theory is one thing and practice is the other. And earth life in Mormon doctrine is all about practice. I'll give you an example of that I never understood till I went to university. In high school, I was really good at chemistry. I got one question only wrong on the final exam. You know, so I did really, really well in it. Then I went to university and enrolled in an organic chemistry class. Sorry, inorganic chemistry class. You know, should be simple stuff. The same thing I've been doing. And the first week of university, I had a lab. So I went into the lab. We were supposed to do some simple, trivial thing, you know, that I could have done on paper and calculated out to however many significant digits you want. And 3.5 hours later, I staggered out smelling of ether, you know, burned all over. I was supposed to have gotten, you know, a gram of white powder. I got about 10% of what I was supposed to get. It was this dirty brown color, you know, and it suddenly chemistry wasn't so easy, right? I knew all the answers, but to actually do it, you know, to put those formulas and those equations into practice, that was a far greater thing. And so I think life is often like that down here. You know, in the premortal world, we knew all the answers. We were all top of the class. We could give the answers easily. But you come down here and you try to apply them and you burn your hands and you stink and you probably wouldn't want to treat yourself with whatever compound you synthesize. You know, don't trust the aspirin. That's what we were doing, is we were making aspirin that day. And they emphasized in the lab over and over, now whatever you do, don't take this aspirin home and eat it, even if you think you did it right. And they were exactly right. I mean, you wouldn't have wanted to give someone the aspirin that I cooked up in the lab. But, you know, despite how lousy I did on that lab, I barely passed it. I knew far more after that short 3.5 hours about what chemistry was and what it took to be a chemist and what the chemical marvels around me, you know, what that cost, if you will, than I ever did, despite my near mastery of the high school material, you know. And so I sometimes think we're more often in that situation than we'd like to believe down here. You know, we're learning some things that we can't learn in any other way, and it's messy and it's gross and it smells, and you really wouldn't want to rely on what we come up with. But Jesus gets us out of that. Nothing but Him matters. And if we trust Him, it'll be okay, even when it seems like it won't.
Spoken like a true physician.
Exactly.
Well done. Well, this has been fun. We've been talking with Greg Smith. You can check out last year's FAIR presentation that he gave, Everything You Always Wanted to Know About Plural Marriage But Were Afraid to Ask. That's available on FAIR's website. He's also
false advertising.
It's also, yeah, it doesn't cover particularly everything, so the title. Tisk on that. But he has also published some reviews with the Farms Review. You've covered a book on polygamy. You've covered a book by Sam Harris about the new atheist movement. Anything else that you've... Are you working on anything right now?
There's something in press on DNA in the Book of Mormon, so that'll be coming soon, I'm told.
Okay, so we'll look forward to that, too. I appreciate you being a guest here on FAIR's podcast. I'm Blair Hodges, and...